Welcome to our second COVID-19 recovery podcast. I'm Chris Southworth, Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce here in the UK. And today I'll be talking to Emmanuel Botold-Stubbs, the Secretary General of ICC France, Gabriela Doliac, Secretary General of ICC Brazil, and Peter Robertson, CEO of the United States Council for International Business. Thank you all for joining me today. My central question for these podcasts is whether there's an emerging consensus from the business community on how the world recovers. And in the last podcast, speaking to colleagues in Africa, Australia, and Singapore, there seemed to be the beginnings of a consensus growing around key areas like the opportunity for reform in all sorts of areas, from labor reform to tax reform to trade reform, and not just at domestic level, but also regional and international level. And then a sort of an emerging consensus that there is a possibility to coexist with this virus. It's not an either a black and white situation, and there are lessons to learn from different countries about how we may be able to operate in a safe way with this sort of health crisis around us. And then lots of talk about the importance of the rules-based trading system as a part of the solution to the crisis, but the need to not take anything for granted and to stand up for the multilateral system for all of us. And then quite a bit of talk about the role of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, as the guardian of the system, and the need for not only for that institution to reform, but actually it should play a really important role in helping us recover. So Emmanuel, I'm going to jump straight to you in France. France has had one of the toughest lockdown regimes of anybody. Has it worked? Has it worked on the ground? What are businesses thinking? How are the businesses coping as the restrictions are starting to lift?
Well, as you just mentioned it, we are in a process of a gradual lifting of the lockdown, and the lockdown has been quite severe given the number of deaths we had so far in France. The key figures of today are 28,000 of deaths and 179,000 of infected people. So these figures are quite high. And of course, the lifting regime has been quite severe. Now we assess that the companies are reopening gradually. The transport system are reopening and functioning up to 70%, for instance, in Paris. The retail food has been open, of course, during the crisis. And now, since last week, all the non-food retails are reopening. It is not the case so far for bars and restaurants, and they are very numerous. And here the risk of bankruptcy is quite high. But we do think if everything goes right in the phase of the lockdown we are, that they could reopen on the 2nd of June. It is very important, of course, for the tourism and the hospitality sector, because you know that France is the number one country for receiving tourists. And it's a very important part of our economy. For the citizens, the freedom of movement is still limited. You cannot go far away than 100 kilometers from your house in the absence of a compelling reason. And regarding the business of the companies, the production is increasing regularly for the industrial production. In average, we are now around 60%, but with large discrepancies regarding the industries. And for instance, of course, we have big concerns about three sectors in particular. The number one, of course, is air transport with the situation of Air France KLM. The second big industrial sector that is worrying is Airbus and the aeronautics with a decline in the production and some social decision maybe that will be made soon. And of course, the automotive industry, because the drop in the sales has been huge in March and April, something like minus 80% or minus 85% in the sales of brand new cars. But I think there are some reasons for optimism regarding the fact that the economic package and the stimulus package has been very wide, very comprehensive, covering both social, fiscal, and economic measures. And we do think that it will have positive effect in the medium run, without avoiding, of course, some bankruptcies and an increase of the unemployment level. I will come back to the reform later.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. Lots of parallels with the UK. I think we're a bit behind you, actually. But the sector's so same in terms of the high risk and all the same challenges. Gabriela, Brazil, at least from the outside world's perspective, has taken perhaps one of the most controversial approaches to the virus, going into the sort of lockdown, if you like, and also has this sort of federal structure to get over in terms of the challenge. What's going on the ground over there? How are businesses coping in the different federal states and different structures?
Well, Chris, I think Brazil may have the very unfortunate honor of perhaps becoming the country with the most complicated situation. I think Brazil certainly, when the cases started, had not a very sharp increase in cases, but one of the major countries that has not shown any flattening, any decrease at all, whereas the UK and the US, you know, right now are showing some control of new cases. Brazil so far has around 200,000 cases. We have, I think, over 16,000 dead, but we have a serious case of under-testing. The government has not, and when I say the government, it's federal, state, and cities, has not been able to coalesce around one strategy. And I think that has been incredibly damaging to all of us. There's a lot of fight between the president and, you know, if we talk about the federal level, even at the federal level, you don't have agreement on what to do. So you have the president becoming perhaps more and more isolated on his perception that we should just open everything up. We should do vertical lockdown, and that businesses in Brazil cannot cope with prolonged lockdown. The truth is, we haven't had a lockdown. We've had quarantine, but the adherence to that has been very low, I think around 50%. You see a lot of piecemeal, sort of last-minute policies that are put in place without any analysis of what the actual impact will be. So a good example is that last week, the city of São Paulo implemented a car restriction. We already have car circulation restriction, but they implemented one that actually forced people to use public transportation. So even if their objective was for people to stay at home, people are not being able to stay at home. Some people really have to go to work because they don't have any other source of income. So you saw people, you know, having to ride packed train, buses, and if your objective was for people to be less subjected to contamination, that royally backfired. So I think it's a lot of these sort of spur-of-the-moment decisions that really have no analysis of why are we doing this, what's the point of doing this, and it could be that we're coming into a lockdown. We've been in quarantine for 2 months, so that's already very punishing for the economy and socially as well. And we're nowhere near getting to a point of, okay, we feel we're a little bit more in control. Some states have had complete collapse of the health system. They don't have any more capacity for treatment. São Paulo state, which is the richest state in Brazil by far, is nearing that as well. And Brazil does have a public health system that should have been, you know, more or less able to absorb these cases, but that's where we're nearing collapse. And on top of all of this, we have another big corruption allegation against the president. So we're just adding layers of difficulties towards this really serious situation. In terms of businesses, I think in a positive side, I think companies in Brazil, the big companies, the companies that have the resources, are really sort of realizing that if they don't step up, if they don't position themselves, this is going to be a catastrophe for Brazil. So you do start to see some really interesting initiatives in terms of cooperation, on how to get more credit to small businesses, on how to provide protective gear to hospitals. So there is a lot of that. But the, I think, overall theme in Brazil is confusion, lack of coordinated approach, and a lot of political infighting, which is really, really unfortunate.
Yeah, there's lots of parallels with that story. I think speaking to the others last week, that, you know, if there's one thing this virus is doing, it's just brutal, and it's exposure, isn't it? And every country is exposing everybody in different ways, whether it's inequalities in housing or whether it's the structures between sort of government structures of countries or gender inequalities, health inequalities, just ruthless in that regard. Peter, I know there's been lots of challenges over there. There's three of us actually who've got the unenviable title of having the most of something, all the wrong most of us actually for that matter. Obviously the US is the hardest hit country of all. What are US companies saying and how are they responding to what's going on?
So Gabriele, you're taking away the honor of most complicated from us, the US. We have a similar situation to Brazil. As you know, we have been hard hit and we're a big country. There is flattening that's taking place in epicenters like New York, Connecticut, where we are, but there are still increases in cases and deaths going on elsewhere in the country. And meanwhile, you know, after several months of this real struggle between those who are concerned still about going back to work too early and those who just want to get back to work, whatever, or high water. And I think there's also been a little bit of a struggle between the central government and the states. There's some tension between the administration's path forward and each individual state's path forward, or at least what they're comfortable with. So we're seeing that. But the impact has been pretty dramatic. You know, in the first quarter, our GDP contracted almost 5%, which was the worst since 2008. Retail sales dropped almost 9% in March, which was the steepest drop since 1992, and it's gotten worse since. And we've got over 30 million people filing jobless claims. So it's pretty dramatic. So I think that the companies now have been operating to a large degree, our member companies, in a crisis management mode. In the first instance, they're concerned about the safety of their employees, but they're going above and beyond normal operations to provide relief. I mean, we've got plenty of examples of companies like, you know, Procter & Gamble, MasterCard, and others that are joining in relief efforts in the United States and around the world, and then planning for the future. But I think the one concern that we all share in the business community is that, you know, globalization could have a setback. The freedom of investment and trade may be challenged. Global supply chains stand a chance of being substantially changed, and governments are, you know, going to strengthen their power to take control over economy and society. So I think that for us, and we'll probably get into this more later, but, you know, COVID-19 knows no boundaries. It's a one world enemy and we need a one world response to it. We've really got to do our best to reach hands across borders and work cooperatively within the multilateral system to effectively respond to the virus on all fronts. I think it's become clear to us that only working through an all-out international cooperative coordinated effort can we stop this pandemic and rebuild better and stronger. We need to have every institution out there, every multilateral institution, whether they're involved in trade, humanitarian issues, health issues, economic and environmental roles, to be working on this together and cooperatively with the private sector.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of pattern, isn't it? The private sector seems to be, you know, obviously massively challenged by just some of the realities of this crisis, but also some really positive things going on in terms of cooperation and seeing the opportunity, I suppose, to come back stronger, doing things differently. I seem to be picking that up from various places. It's certainly the same case here in the UK. But there is this growing anti-globalization narrative that we need to be very concerned about. We had enough problems before this virus overtook the world. Now we've got even more problems in the sense that there's a significant amount of people, politicians, governments putting in place measures that are blocking trade and a sort of rising feeling that actually globalization is part of the problem here. Emmanuel, maybe I'll come to you on that question. How do we come back with a counter narrative that we haven't used already, or do we just need to boot a narrative that we already have. How do we come back and make the case for open trade in the current environment?
Well, the situation in France regarding globalization is to a certain extent specific, because France is one of the most open economy in which the feelings of the citizens regarding globalization have always been very critical. So when you are in a political debate in France, you will have a very strong opposition between the so-called globalization zealots and nationalistic or patriot. And this debate has been the debate of the presidential election. But now there have been more and more criticism coming from even the center-right or center-left of the political arena. And of course, with this crisis of COVID, more and more people, including workers, are really genuinely convinced that we have gone too far, we need to go slowly, we need to relocate some essential production, of course, in the health sector in particular. Not only some elements for the health product like paracetamol, it was a big discovery. I don't know if it was the case in other countries, that 80% of the paracetamol was produced in China. And it was really a shock for the public opinion. But not only paracetamol, but also, of course, personal protective equipment with not enough industrial capacity to provide all the care. So now there is really this political debate of relocation of some specific industrial production. They could be linked directly to health product, pharmaceutical product, personal protective equipment. But there is also this debate at the EU level with the Commissioner Thierry Breton to start a global reflection on the strategic industrial sectors for the EU as a whole, with, of course, pharmaceutical industry, aeronautics, and there are, I think, around 10 sectors. I think that for the moment, the public opinion is really not in a good mood regarding globalization. And of course, the reputation of China is not very, very high. So I think that any attempt to find out a new narrative for globalization will be difficult to be heard by the French public opinion now, unless it covers new social demands, meaning climate change. We need a trade policy that will help us to achieve our commitments with the Paris Agreement. We need a new trade policy that will help us to be in compliance with the due diligence law that we have in France. We know that we are pioneer, that since 2017, we have a law on the duty of vigilance. And now it is an idea which is more and more popular for the European Commission. And we are expecting a directive next year. And of course, it will cover for the social impacts and human rights, not only the operational activities of the companies, but also the way they are handling their supply chain. So any new narrative in France could be heard only if it will cover climate change and inclusiveness and social and labor standards.
That's interesting. Just before I move on to the others, I mean, is there an appetite to be quite radical here? Is there a sense that there's we could be ripping regulations up in order to promote trade, or is it actually the reverse?
It's a difficult question. For the moment, the emergency is to save people to get out of this crisis. And I mean, the attention that people can pay to the globalization, it's not really the moment. Everything will arrive through the European ambition with the new commission and the 5 years mandate. But at national level, very, very difficult. We will have some reflection on our own domestic reform, but I don't think I can be very optimistic in this field, because I do think that all the reform that were planned by Macron and his government will not take place at the end. The reform of the labor market, it will be delayed. The reform of the pension, highly controversial, it will be delayed. So, and of course, the reform of the health system, then a lot of investment will be made after the crisis. whatever the cost, whatever it takes. It was really the one of the strong sentences of the first statement made by Macron at the beginning of the crisis. We will try to save life, whatever the price, whatever it takes.
So let me move on to you, Peter, if I can go in another order. I mean, what's the feeling in the US? Is there a counter-narrative to globalization? Is there an appetite to be radical in order to generate enough growth in the recovery from COVID crisis?
I don't think there's a lot of appetite or talk right now of being radical and looking at new ways forward. Right now, it's, you know, dealing with the current emergency and beginning to look at the future, new ways of doing work. Undoubtedly, there is going to be some impact on supply chains. I think it's pretty sure that all our respective governments are going to realize that maybe some things got a little too far removed and are going to want to bring things back home, whether it's, you know, medical technology or similar types of industries. But I think that we need to recognize that's going to happen, but we also need to beware of unilateralism, and we need to provide a good counterbalance to that, because it's just a fact that globalization is a fact and global supply chains are a fact. And there are plenty of SMEs around the world, not only in the United States, but in Latin America and elsewhere, who are part of these global supply chains. And these are some of the kinds of enterprises that are being very hard hit in terms of damage to lives and livelihoods these days. I think that we really do need to be concerned about that and realize that the SMEs, like for me, for example, coming from the Americas, the SMEs all throughout the Americas are important for their own national economies, but they're also important for major supply chains. And that's why we're, as ICC USA, very much supportive of ICC's Save Our SMEs campaign, which recommends the governments provide direct and immediate support to small businesses to ensure their continued operation and to workers, particularly in those vulnerable economies. And we've also written to Secretary Pompeo in the United States, urging him to do everything possible to ensure that multilateral development banks help steer financing and funds to SMEs and to prevent, try to do what they can to prevent foreclosures, to look at social protection systems, allowing for bridging financing for workers until they can get back to work, and then to provide technical assistance to companies and SMEs when they're back in operation. So I think we need to be balancing the kind of tendency to return back home with the reality that global supply chains are here to stay, and we have a responsibility to be looking at the conditions not only in our own countries, but those around the world.
So it's a more of a situation evolving and accelerating perhaps what was already happening, maybe, is kind of what I'm hearing. Gabriel, I'm going to come to you now. Just building off what people are saying here, do you feel, coming from a different angle, that some policies should be now prioritized over and above others, whether that's digitization, more of a focus on sustainability, to the points about onshoring supply chains? What do you think? I mean, we know that the overall goal at a global level of the 2030 agenda, that actually a lot of this is already written out actually in an action plan, isn't it, within the sustainable development goals. Should we now start taking priorities? What's your view on that?
I think, like Peter said, I think there's finding the right balance of how do you deal with such a humanitarian crisis, a health crisis as we have now, but you also at the same time sort of introduce concepts that maybe people would find a luxury right now. So for example, Emmanuel mentioned, you know, the environment issue. How do we connect sustainability to the rebuild? And if you look at a country like Brazil, where, you know, as opposed to France and others, it's a very closed country in terms of trade for its size in comparison, there's still a lot of resistance to themes that are viewed a little bit sort of, oh, that's, you know, a luxury for rich countries. If we're talking about sustainability, if we're talking about the digitalization, all of this is, it's luxury. on the ground right now, we have, you know, layoffs. We really need the country to come through for the industry. We have to make sure that we protect our industry, which is something that has happened in Brazil forever. And this is a recipe that has not worked for Brazil. We're so behind in a lot of topics. So I think it's finding the right way to connect why these topics such as social inclusion, sustainability, and sustainability, I think it's a varied topic in terms of governance, integrity, environment, bigger cooperation. How do we link that to a sustainable economic recovery? How do you build a narrative that says, look, Res, we acknowledge that right now we're at a crisis, but not only do we need to get over this crisis, but we have an opportunity here as we're rethinking how to restart economies, how do we re-engage with partners, how do we do that perhaps in a different ways? And I think in some societies, that discussion is a lot easier. I think perhaps France and the UK and Germany, I think that for the average population, that is, you know, a discussion that they've been having for a while. In Brazil, that's not. We're still at the, you know, at the start of the discussion, whether, you know, we should open our economy a little bit more. I mean, if you talk imports in Brazil, people start getting tense. People do get anxiety in terms of, well, but what about the local industry? It's a really hard mentality to change. And I think Brazil has done a lot of great strides economically with this government and perhaps the previous government in understanding that being more connected globally is not a bad thing, that we have the capacity to do. Yes, there's a lot we need to do internally, but it is a good thing. But we also had the strengthening of perhaps a more ideological rejection of globalization, of, you know, however they interpret it. So it's a really, I think it's sort of a paradox in the sense that I think it's one of the times, and I think Peter said it's sort of a one world, one response. And, you know, there's no doubt that that's what we need to do. But at the same time, you're going to have such a big emotional response to, right now, I'm focused on having food on the table. I'm focused on keeping my job. So whatever needs to happen to make sure that, you know, I get to eat every day, that needs to be the priority. So, and perhaps there's a reflection on why, you know, ICC and others, have we been able to translate all of these topics such as SDGs and how they actually benefit, that these are not luxuries, that these are the foundation for, you know, a more sustainable future. Perhaps we haven't. And so how do we do that? And I'm not sure we have an immediate answer. So I think that's the main challenge for countries, for ICC, is how do you make that better link? Because right now people will ask you, well, I need to eat. So if I need to protect this industry so I get to eat, what's our response?
And presumably that's a similar conversation. And if Brazil's having that conversation at that level, then it'll be even tougher in many other countries around the world, won't it? I think we have to be very alert to that. Let me just sort of bring on to the WTO as a sort of final area just to ask questions. Obviously, the WTO has had a challenging time anyway. What's the future of the WTO at the moment? I mean, we've got Roberto Azevedo obviously has just announced his retirement this week. A stalling of the programme, the ministerial conference in the middle of the year is being rescheduled to next year. We're in the middle of some big negotiations on digital trade, e-commerce and investment facilitation and so on, MSMEs. Emmanuel, let me come to you then. In terms of the WTO, what's the view in France on the future of the WTO? Should we be more concerned than we were before?
Well, of course, WTO is in a deep crisis, and the resignation before the end of the term of Roberto Azevedo was another very bad news. And I think that it's like in psychoanalysis. You need first to recognize that you have a big problem. We have a big problem inside WTO. We have the paralysis of the appellate body. We have the failure to deliver any multilateral negotiation except the trade facilitation. We have the inability to obtain any changes in the behavior of China inside WTO regarding subsidies, industrial subsidies, regarding the openness of its public procurement, and regarding, of course, protection of intellectual rights. So we need to assess the magnitude of the crisis in order to fix the crisis. But of course, I don't know if we can come up to a kind of consensus between members of the WTO. The EU already made some proposal during the last meeting of the General Council. They are very clear. And the new EU trade policy will be inspired by this principle I touched already upon. Now we are waiting for our traditional allies in the defense of the multilateralism to go forward and to obtain results, because otherwise it will be really the disappearance of the WTO. And WTO is unique, and the cost of the disappearance of the WTO is huge for all of us, for the SMEs, for the large companies, for the functioning of the global supply chain, for the consumers. Let's show that we are ambitious enough for a genuine reform of the WTO.
Do you think that the reform program is the number one priority now? The WTO surely has an important, fundamentally important role in the recovery of the global economy after the COVID crisis. So do you think now we should be focusing in solely on the reform program and getting to grips with some of the issues you've just laid out very explicitly there?
But I think, of course, there is a short-term agenda and a medium-term agenda, but we should act at the two levels with the same level of ambition. Of course, WTO should be used in the recovery of the global value chains and the global supply chain with classical principle. But on the other hand, we need to introduce a coherence, for instance, between the Paris Agreement and WTO rules and disciplines. You know, for instance, that in the preamble of the WTO, there is a reference to sustainable development. Now we should state it between us, between members of the WTO, that this reference, it covers actually the Paris Agreement, and that this link between trade and climate should be recognized officially. Because more and more members of the WTO will take ambitious climate measures, be it at domestic level or be it at the border. So we will have to face a new generation of trade conflicts need to climate if the WTO is not making progress to align trade policy and climate policy. This is one of our most emergency priority for us in the French business community, and the same thing for the government.
Gabriella, is the view in Brazil the same? You know, the WTO has a fundamentally important role, must get into the reform program and must start delivering more action. Is that the feeling on the ground there too?
I think for Brazil, the WTO has been very, very important. So I think the governments and businesses here will recognize that. But there is also a recognition that it hasn't sort of kept up with the new challenges, that it needs to rethink. You know, there hasn't been any, like Emmanuel put, any considerable trade agreement. So how do you modernize that? I think perhaps there's a big important distinction that we as business society should reinforce with our governments. That is, one is the WTO as it was not working and it needs to reform itself. But that doesn't mean that the multilateral trade system does not work. I think that's a big distinction that needs to be made. Obviously, the exit from Roberto Azevedo is unfortunate. I think on various levels, he certainly was someone who was trying to rethink the organization, who's a very good negotiator. But perhaps out of, you know, him leaving early and the questions that it does raise, this is a massive opportunity for businesses to really have a conversation with the governments to say, look, just because it wasn't working doesn't mean we don't need it. And Brazil especially should be driving this conversation, because it has been really important to have the WTO as a dispute resolution mechanism. So I think it's perhaps making them, it wasn't working, but that doesn't mean we don't really need it. And it's not an easy fix, right? There's all sorts of interests. I think, like Emmanuel said, how do you bring these more innovative, modern challenges to the WTO? It's really hard to get consensus when you have, you know, 190 plus countries. So is that still how the WTO is going to operate? Is there an alternative to that that makes sense? I don't know that anybody has sort of this is exactly how it will function, but just to stress, I think what we need to say right now is we do need the WTO. We just need a better WTO. And the, you know, to your question, Chris, of, you know, whether that needs to be a priority, I fully concur with Emmanuel. I think you have the immediate agenda, but you also have the immediate need to try to accelerate the discussions of what a reform looks like. And I think it starts by, you know, who will take over. I think that's a really important signal of, you know, where WTO will go, where members want the WTO to go. It's a lot of questions, and I think ICC has a big role in bringing the voice of the business community to say, we still support it, we just need to start rebuilding it.
I agree.
Yeah, Peter, I mean, it's good to segue to you in the US. I mean, obviously it sounds like we've got great consensus on the need for the WTO. I think it's a really important point just made there by Gabriella that reform is not about not having a multilateral system. It's about having a better system and a better organization and institution. Emmanuel making the same point. What's your perspective?
I agree with what has been said. We need a stronger WTO. WTO is the kind of organization we need now to rebuild from this current crisis we're in. We're economic recovery is going to need national governments to restore global trade through keeping markets open as much as possible for trade and investment, trying to keep strong macroeconomic policy going to ensure stability, resisting unilateralism and going in a protectionist way. We need businesses working with governments for more resilient and flexible supply chains, especially in essential areas like healthcare, food, and energy. We need to be ensuring developing countries' economies are being supported and not fail. We need customs policies that continue to allow for fast movement of products across borders while addressing health and safety. And all of these are things that the WTO stands for and needs to have a voice on. And the UN Secretary General launched the Global Humanitarian Assistance Campaign recently, and Director General Acevedo of the WTO has been urging all countries to remove barriers to essential goods and services to respond to the health crisis. That's the kind of necessary messaging we need at the international level. So we'll be very sorry to see Roberto Acevedo leaving. He's been a very steady hand, very challenging period, but hopefully we'll be able to find solid successor to keep the legacy going.
Hey, look, I've got to cut it off here now. I mean, we could go on and talk for ages because I think, you know, these are always so interesting. It's particularly interesting listening to different views from different countries where we agree, where the challenges are. Whatever the case, the challenges are going to be huge, aren't they, over the next coming months and years. Well, thank you to our speakers today, and thanks to all the listeners. Really appreciate your time too. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. I think what I'm taking away from this in terms of my central question, is there a global consensus emerging? I think there is a global consensus emerging, but the challenge we have are taking different forms in different countries, but there is a sort of central theme that we need to safeguard the multilateral rules-based trading system, but it does need reform, and we need to grab the opportunity to then reform at domestic level as well as regional level, not just at international level. And we're in a time of massive change, and there are opportunities there, and there are threats. And I think from what I'm hearing from everybody, we're all feeling the same in varying shapes and sizes. So it's going to be tough times ahead, but lots of positive things coming out of the business community too, in terms of more cooperation, some really good practice coming, good thinking coming, particularly from the sort of the companies that have the capacity to do that right now, even though we're still in the middle of a major pandemic. So I think I'm upbeat about what I'm hearing, but slightly challenged by it as well. And I hope this has been insightful and useful for all of you listening. Thank you very much.